Hi, and welcome to Embark. I'm Liz Solar, and when I'm not doing this podcast, I do voiceover, which includes commercials and corporate narrations, all types of audio applications. So where we use our physical voice to actually voice things out loud, there is also such a thing as the writer's voice. And we'll get to why this is all happening right now. But first, I'd like to tell you a little bit about Anne Janser. She's an award-winning author, nonfiction writing coach, and self-proclaimed writing geek. So she's my kind of girl. She loves to guide people to find more joy in their writing, which can be kind of iffy for a lot of us, and supports and encourages writers and authors and marketers through her books, blog, online courses, webinars, and teaching The Woman Never Sleeps. In addition to that, she explores the science and practice of effective writing and has produced several books, including Writing to be Understood and 33 Ways Not to Screw Up Your Business Emails. And I think we could all use a little bit of help with that. We'll get to that another time. Her latest is the fifth in the Writer's Process series. I think it's the fifth, and it's called The Writer's Voice: Techniques for Tuning Your Tone and Style. And Anne is with us today to talk about the writer's voice. Please welcome Anne Janser. Hello, friend.
Hi, friend. It's nice to be back, Liz.
It's great to see you as well. You know, we all have that physical voice that we use, and it has its own tone and timbre and pitch, and it's like a fingerprint. People talk about the voice print being the same as a fingerprint. It's unique. It's authentic to us, and it can convey all types of emotions and attitudes, and often in different ways. We have different tones that we use for different people, say a child as opposed to an adult, or your boss or your colleague or your romantic partner. So we modulate our physical voice in different ways. But in this book, you explore all about the writing voice. I don't think most people think about that in terms of, I think we know it when we see it, but we probably wouldn't identify it as such. So talk about the writer's voice. What is it?
Yeah. So it's something that's so nebulous that we have to use a metaphor of the physical voice to get our head around it, for one thing, right? I mean, that's to some extent, we cling to that metaphor. It's a voice. We talk about that. We think about having an authentic one. It's something I feel like it's very little understood in the writing world. I know that poets and literary writers will be searching for an authentic voice, and they may try things to create something that always sounds uniquely them. And there are writers that you will read and you'll say, oh, that's a Hemingway, or, you know, that you'll spot the voice. So people want that sometimes in their work. So there's a voice in that sense. But everything that we write implies a voice. And oddly enough, and this is so fascinating to me, Liz, because oddly enough, the metaphor of this, the speaking voice for the writing voice, is more true than we realize. So there's this psychologist who did a study, and he found that maybe 70% of the people he surveyed hear a reading voice in their head when they read silently. A part of their brain is kind of like a little audiobook narrator in their ear, narrating to them at a faster clip than a real narrator would do, of course, because it's not actually spoken. But we actually do construct a voice in our heads as we read silently. So everything that you write has a voice in your reader's head in most cases, which is fascinating when you think about that.
It is, because I think we've all read books and say, oh, I really see this person one way. And as someone in advertising told me a long time ago, is some people say a picture tells 1,000 words, but sometimes a word can evoke 1,000 pictures. You know, a snake, what do you think of? Is it, you know, is it a green garden snake? Is it a cobra? You know, we can have different ideas of what that word means. And it's fascinating that there's this survey that comes up with 70% of people who are readers actually get that voice. They get that particular person who's speaking to them. But you did your own survey about the writer's voice.
Yes, I did. I was fascinated to find out, what do people really think about? If we get at, let's leave the world of poets and get to the rest of us. Because as I work with nonfiction authors on their works, there are certain people for whom their personality comes through really clearly in the writing, right? So it's like, their voice is there. And others sometimes get in the way of their personal voice. And so I'll talk to them a little bit about writing stylistic things maybe that are obscuring who they are, you know, that it, so voice is there too for all of us. So I was very curious. So I did a survey of the writers in my community about, you know, how do you feel about your writing voice? And most people are like, yeah, you know, a scale of 3 to 5, they're all like 3, 4, or 5. Yeah, it's pretty good. I'm fine. No problem. Good. Good to go. So I thought, oh, crikeys, I'm writing a book about voice, you know, maybe this isn't the right topic. but then I asked further questions. It's like, well, do you modify your voice as you write? And most people either didn't change anything, they just wrote, or they might go through and do little minor edits. Like I might take out this word and use a stronger one, or might just clean up a little bit. And only a very small percentage felt that they could easily switch voices in their work. These maybe are people who are ghostwriters or fiction writers who write in different voices. And that was like less than 20% of the people that I surveyed. And then I asked if people would change anything about their voice. And people said, oh, yeah, I wish it was this, or I wish it was that, or I wish it was that. So it came clear to me that we're all kind of struggling with what is this idea of voice, and how happy am I with mine, and could I change it? If I could change it, would I change it in any small way? So it gave me confidence that I should go ahead and write a book on voice so that we could explore this topic together and people could maybe have the fun of experimenting with and understanding their writing voice.
I think you had a quote from, was it Don Fry? About
yes.
The writer's voice being a kind of a selected strategy. Was that the, I'm trying to find the, oh, it's the sum of writing strategies that creates the illusion that the writer is speaking directly to the reader from the page or screen. I rarely think about, unless you're thinking about, how am I going to market this book, about strategy.
Yes.
But he may be speaking about something else. Can you talk to that?
There is strategy always. Even leaving beyond marketing, if I'm writing, if I want to persuade you to do something, or if I'm writing an essay about something I believe strongly about, so I have choices of how I want to influence you or have you feel about it. I can come out really strongly shouting about all my beliefs, but if I think about how that's going to land with you, if you don't believe the way I do, that's probably not going to work, right? Because, you know, we see a lot of that actually in the world today.
Too much.
Shouty, 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 shouty. And it's not working. So let's just put that aside for a moment. So writing, we do have strategies. Is thinking, well, how is someone approaching this? How are they reading it? If someone's going to be reading something on their phone, there's a simple strategy of I need to keep my sentences and paragraphs shorter because the phone just isn't as conducive to long, long blocks of text. Tends to scare away people when they're reading on the phone. There's strategies that way. There's strategies in terms of, should I say, you need to do this? Or should I say, if we do this thing, we will make this impact? Or, you know, what pronouns do I use? All of these are strategies. And they all have subtle effects on how the reader then reconstructs the voice of the piece. So it's interesting because voice seems like this natural, you know, authentic part of who you are and your personality. And yet, when it's in black and white on the page, it's made up of stylistic decisions, which is, so it's both strategy and nature.
Do you think because writing is also an activity that most of us do in isolation, being in one's head, does that affect how the voice comes out? I mean, I know a lot of voice actors, a lot of actors in general, I never watch myself on screen. I don't want to see it. I don't want to be influenced by it. I hate the way my voice sounds. Does the same ring true for most writers when they're reading this and saying, ugh, that just sounds terrible? Put aside the conventions of grammar and spelling and all of those technical pieces.
You know, I think it depends. I know a lot of writers who will say, you know, I can't bear to read anything I wrote 3 or 4 years ago. And I think that's often a sign of growth in the craft, that they've surpassed where they were. And that's great. So if that happens, that's great. I worked for a long time as a corporate marketer, and I ghostwrote for all these different brands. And every now and then I'd read something and go on a client's website and I go, no, that's pretty interesting. I like that. That's good. Hey, wait, did I write that? So I couldn't remember because I was so adept at writing in the voice of the brand that I would have to go back and look at my files. It's like, oh yeah, I wrote that. All right. It stood up. I'm happy with that. So I think the key in writing, and this may be the key in performing as well, but let's just put that aside. The key in writing is to not focus on yourself, but to be focused on the reader. And that's the key. That's how you revise so that it works. It's not about you. It's never about you. It's always about the reader. Your success lies with them and not with you. And when you're writing, you're actually writing, you're more likely to get into a positive kind of flow state if you're not critiquing what you're writing, but if you're focusing on your objective, what you're doing and why. So we have to get out of our heads in so many ways, but one of them is just stop worrying about how we sound and have some faith that we can fix and tune and tweak things in revision and then make them serve the reader, because that's what it's about. It's about serving the reader.
Absolutely. I agree with everything you just said. And it goes for everything. I mean, whether it's a performance-based art or whether it's commerce-based or the intersection of the two, we're always trying to serve the person on the other end, the receiver, and hoping that it's a good experience. And getting out of our own way can sometimes add to the success of actually connecting with another person.
Yeah. So, you know, I also, I am a classically trained singer, right? And I like to sing. And so I put it aside for a while. I came back to as an adult and I'd start performing again. It's like, gosh, why am I so nervous when performing? And then I just decided I had to reset. This is not about me. As soon as I stand up there and open my mouth to sing, it's because they are here to hear this piece from the Messiah, or they are here to really enjoy this thing. And it's about giving, it's about fulfilling their needs, the audience, and they want to enjoy this. They want to sit there and enjoy this. So let's just go with that. And it helps performance-wise because it gets you out of that moment of worrying about yourself. You know, the self-reflection is not helpful.
No, I had no idea that you were a singer. So one more talent that I didn't know about. So amazing about that. When you're writing words down on your screen or on a page, do you think about the musicality of the words that you're using?
Yes, I think, you know, I've started doing that more. I started that I really when I took a poetry class and I realized, you know, I'm listening. This is about listening. And then as I was working on this book, I realized, you know, the sentences that I like have a certain musicality. And really the ear, if you think about the readers listening to this, right? It's not even as an audiobook, even if it's just in print, they're listening to it. So if you add a moment of alliteration, or if you look at some internal rhyme, or if you just pay attention to the rhythm, change the rhythm of the sentences, you create something that is more. That is, you know, language is not just black and white. Language is this exchange you and I are having. It has tone. It has rhythm. It is musical in a way.
Do you have certain authors that you read and say, oh, I really get both the musicality and the economy of language, and I'm really following the story and I get that clear sense of voice?
Yeah. You know, and I delight now sometimes when I pick up things. And what pains me is I read some of these works, you know, in high school or college, right? And you read Steinbeck and you're like, oh, let's get to the plot, you know. And now I open it up, I'm like, oh, the language, you know, I just stop and I savor it differently, which is interesting. I don't think I was ready in high school to do that.
Well, some of it's so rich and written by people at a certain point in their lives where they might have learned something. They might not live it, but they are definitely able to write about it. And before I forget, is to talk about the format of your book, which I think is brilliant because it's part informative, how to, that sounds reductive, but there's a lot of craft to it. It does definitely have a tone. I really do feel like you are speaking to me.
Good.
Also, there's some homework, and it's a lot of it's really fun homework to do. A lot of times we like to use smart words to show we know something. Here's my educational level. I'm pretty good. Or why use that simple word when I can say something that makes me sound a little bit more lofty? And I loved this exercise of rewriting something or writing something with one syllable words. And I really challenged myself with that. It was amazing.
It's crazy hard, isn't it? It's crazy hard.
It's really hard, but it demands that you be precise and have an intention about what you're writing. And you have some really wonderful gems. And one of the things, going back to talking about that speech or that those words, whether they're written down or we're saying them out loud, there has to be a way to say them smoothly and so that they're understandable and that people will stay with them and not get tripped up. And you kind of took us through the history. You know, first there was the oral tradition where people passed down stories through the generations, and maybe they got changed a little bit or, you know, along the way, but those were the stories. And then many years later come printing presses and text-to-speech and AI and audiobooks, and it's, you know, everything that's old is new again. And writing for those opportunities to translate your work into audio, talk a little bit about what trips up authors, writers, when they're writing, and things to perhaps watch out for.
Yeah, so that is such a great point. You know, we've come back to things being read aloud to us again. And I think that we as writers have to think about that. I wrote my very first book was about marketing. I wrote it in 2015. And then later that year, I thought, well, I'm going to record the audiobook of it because, you know, I'm a trained singer. I can record an audiobook. And I have nothing but respect for what you do, Liz. Let me just put this out. So I realized as I was writing it, I had sentences that were just kind of awkward and unwieldy. I mean, I thought my writing was nice and smooth, but it's a whole different thing trying to read it out loud. And then I had sometimes word choices and then subscription. If you say that word five times fast, it will trip up even you.
Say digital a bunch of times. Yeah.
There you go. Okay. So it's like, okay. So I realized going forward, it's like every book I rewrite, I'm actually writing an audiobook script too. And I need to think about that. And I would challenge anyone writing a book to think about that as you're editing and revising. You don't have to think about it when you're drafting. Stay out of your way when you're drafting. But as you're editing and revising, think about the fact that it is, in fact, a script. And it shouldn't have to be a script that you mark up wildly with, you know, emphasize this word. If you find yourself italicizing things to make the sentence structure flow, you probably need a simpler sentence structure. So a good book should make a very good audiobook script. That's my theory now writing. And even if you're not planning to do an audiobook, because again, your reader is reconstructing it in their head as, let's just call it a little inner magic audiobook as they're reading. So you should think about that.
We consume so much of our media in video, and it might be short. Before, people would say, you know, a couple minutes. Now it's 30 seconds, 60 seconds. Just give me that sound bite and let me get on with the rest of my day. The other thing is we're perusing so much more of it too. We're actually looking for that content and really getting the headlines, not really getting the story. So writing a book is asking someone to commit.
It is asking someone to commit and to commit, you know, if you're asking them to do deep reading, that's something they're not as practiced with. Because again, in this world today, all of us are busy skimming, consuming these short bites. So you really need to think about that, where your reader is and how do you reach them. And you can ask people to do deep reading, but I have an analogy. I'll share this with you. It's like a little video game, right? So the reader pays one token to show up and read your thing. All right. And then every time they hit a word that is really complicated or unfamiliar or hard to pronounce, they pay another token. If they reach a sentence where it goes on so long that they can't remember what the subject was, they pay another token. If they reach, extraneous use of jargon or Latin, more tokens, right? And then if they get a really great idea, they win some tokens, right? And if they understand something new or you tell them a story that engrosses them, they earn tokens, right? So it's like this constant exchange. But the problem is this, you have no idea when the reader shows up to play how many tokens are in their hand. If there's only three tokens, and by the end of the first paragraph, they've spent them all, they're gone. So if you think about reading a game like that, writing and reading like a game like that, it makes you really think about how are you supporting the reader.
Do you have different opinions about when to use more flowery or denser language? Think about books that I love, you know, novels by people like Gabriel Garcia Marquez or Salman Rushdie, or even, you know, Jennifer Egan can have really dense language. And these are, you know, modern writers. We're not talking about 19th century writers. Let's not even get into Charles Dickens.
Oh, yeah.
There are some really beautiful passages. And I can remember reading books and not really getting into it until page 60 or 70. A lot of it was set up.
Yeah.
Is there room for those types of books for today's reader?
Yeah. So there will always be masterful writers, you know, and when it's in the pages of a book, you know, when we sit with a book, we are automatically giving it more time and attention than a blog post, let's say, right? We're bringing a different kind of reading to it, hopefully. Especially a fiction book. If you're sitting a fiction book, you're saying, okay, I'm going to immerse myself, and you put your trust in the author, and that trust has to be earned and supported. Now, someone like Salman Rushdie, if I've read something of his before, I come into it with a lot of trust already. So I'm like, I'll give you to page 50. You know, I'm fine, right? Brand new author may not have that trust necessarily. You know, they might need to engage us somehow with the beauty of their prose or with the interest of their plot earlier on, because it's a relationship. You know, reading is a relationship with the author, which is an interesting way to think about it. So yeah, there's still room for this, but you need to be paying attention to what format you're writing for, and who you're writing for and how you think people are showing up for it and what they need. So it depends on genre. It depends on who you are. Yeah, absolutely. Still room for poetry, room for beautiful, yes, beautiful prose in the world, please. Yes. But I would love to see a little more beautiful prose. It's not dense, but just those little snippets of beauty scatter into more of the writing we see everywhere.
That is an excellent point, because I love reading that dense stuff, but sometimes it can go, if you're going on with the description for 7 or 8 pages, as some authors do, and it's wonderful, like it's this little fantasia, but it is that piece where, what were we talking about now? I thought angels' wings or something, and now we're back at the ocean, and
Yeah. You know, I don't know. That's a balance. You just get to decide, okay, my audience is those people who are going to come with me through this. You know, it becomes a self-selecting set that is going to be a smaller audience. I mean, part of it is our attention spans have changed. If you look at, you know, Dickens first serialized, he published his stories first as serial installments in newspapers. So clearly his prose was cool for the general newspaper reading audience. I remember reading Moby Dick years ago. I'm like, what is this chapter on white? You know, I was very impatient. I might be able to read it now differently. I mean, I go back and I'm rereading some things I read earlier in life. And like I said, I have a little more patience now. So maybe I'm a different audience than I once was. And you just need, if you're doing that, you need to be aware that your audience is a very specific set of people who are willing to do that and go with you there.
So for someone who comes to you or comes to the blank page or the blank screen and says, I don't even know what I'm writing, let alone you want me to write in a voice, what does that even mean? Where do I start? And what is the impulse? Is voice something that we come in with, or is it something that we can develop?
Yes and yes. I mean, it is both of those things, right? So what I'd like to do, it is a complex thing. So I structured this book with like 12 different entry points into voice, 12 different ways to think about it. And sometimes I just ask you to take something you've already written and now try doing this and see what happens. And what does that change? And how does that feel compared to what you did before? And sometimes I ask people just, you know, write something and completely insane. You know, I feel like if you ask people, and I learned this from singing too, if you try something that's way too loud and way too soft, you figure out where your real dynamic should be for that. Or you try something, you know, you try the extremes because it tells you something about where you should be. And so that's a fun exercise. I tried to make it really hands-on because I would like people to start to actually stretch a little bit their voices. So many people seem locked in to the way that they were taught to write in college. And academic writing is not the same as the writing we need to do everywhere else. Let's just say that. I know diss to academia, but in academia, you have a captive audience. Your professor has to read it, or their students have to read it. And so in the rest of the world, your audience is not captive. And so everything changes. I want people to just experiment. I never want to get in the way of people drafting, getting your first drafts out, just get them out however you can. But sometimes some of these voice exercises might free you to draft in a different way and to put aside for a moment the way you always wrote in college and to do something completely different. And you might discover the words flow more freely when you set aside some of those preconceptions and find a different aspect of voice that is fluid for you or more fluid for you.
As someone I know says, let your id run free.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. There's time later.
Hang off the jungle gym for a while. How do you approach a piece that's nonfiction? You are put out as the expert. There is a certain level of seriousness to it, but also you are commenting on it. There is some opinion, and you want to be the good host, the servant who is inviting people into that world and sharing that world. How do you balance those two things?
So I like to look at this by saying, okay, what's my relationship with the reader? And if you make that decision up front, some of the writing becomes easier because, again, we're cluing into innate social skills that I hope we have, or most of us have some degree of. Have some degree of social skills. So let's work with the ones we have. All right. So I can say, okay, I'm writing about this topic that I know a lot about. So I can either say, I want to show up to the reader as the authority in this topic. One way to show up. I might want to say, I want to show up as someone who is like, hey, you want to learn something? Come with me and we'll figure it out. So that's sort of a companion. I have this sort of expert or companion discussion or division, but really we usually are somewhere in between. It's like, you know, I've been doing this for a while and this is what I learned here. And this is why this is so. And you might want to know this. So I'm kind of your companion, an expert guide on the trail with you. That's another way to show up. As we think about those things, another thing to think about is even how present are we in the book? If you open a textbook, the authors are usually not present. It's usually some nameless committee of people who wrote this book on physics or something, or math, or I don't know. I'm thinking of textbooks of old. Maybe they're different now. But, you know, it's just, this is the truth. Accept it. So the author is absent. In a memoir, they're present. A lot of the things we do in nonfiction world are somewhere in between. We're sort of there. We're there. But it's not about us.
Right. I mean, there is a certain level of being guided by somebody into some information or being offered some information. And I agree with you about those textbooks. Those are the driest things. And yep. I don't know what to say about that. There was something that I wanted to ask you about the first half of your book. You reference the outer work of voice. And then for the second half, you talk about the inner work of voice. So this voice thing is multi-layered. And talk about what that means.
Right. Yeah. What are the differences? Well, if you go back to that definition that we shared, it was voice is what the strategies that exist on the page. So that's the outer work, what's on the page, to influence what the reader perceives. So that's the inner work is what is going on in our brains, our communication from my thoughts and feelings to your thoughts and feelings. So I think that we can come at this in multiple angles. And the outer work is those stylistic decisions. Should I use a semicolon or an M dash? Right? I mean, that says something too about how formal or structured you are, or it gives rhythm to the prose. There's all of the word choice, all of those things. So we can work with just on the page, what's on the page, or we can also work with what's our inner motivation as we're writing. What's my relationship with the reader? What do I hope for them? What tone do I hope to establish? Those are more emotional decisions or intuitive. They're more what's going on in our heads than what's going on the page. They influence what ends up on the page.
So what was your intention as you were writing this book and then adding all these great exercises for people to do as they absorb what information you offered? Okay, here's a little exercise that you can do. And they were really fun because they were presented in a really non-threatening way and got me to think about things like, oh, alliteration, you can use those even in really serious books.
Yeah, that's right. So fun. I'm so glad you said they were fun because that was totally my objective. Honestly, Liz, I'm going to tell you, you want to hear the story of this book?
Of course.
As I started writing this, it was going to just be a usual book, like one of my books, you know, 30, 40,000 words of this and that. And then I thought, well, maybe I'll do a companion workbook. And then I started, as I was writing the draft, I kept coming up with these exercises and thinking, oh, you know what would be really, really fun? Well, let me try this and I'll do this. And so I was having so much fun with the exercises. And then I realized, you know, I can give someone a book on voice, but it's working on your voice is not a spectator sport. It's something you actually have to do. And I think the exercises need to be in the book. So I need to pare down the book part of it and expand the exercise and mush them all together and put blank spaces and say, pick up the pen and write here. I really want to encourage people to pick up a pen. So the print book has a lot of, you know, lines and things to write on because you won't actually, you have to play with this to get something from it. And that's my real goal for people is that they actually try things and have fun with them. So I tried to frame them as just sort of fun laboratory experiments. I mean, crazy exercises, nothing you're going to show anyone, but just to get a sense of what is really going on with your voice. And maybe you have more possibilities for your writing than you had realized. That's my hope.
Well, I think that's a very good intention to have. And I love that you wanted this to be fun. And you talk about introducing writers to the joy of writing. And it's missing from so much of life. And earlier you alluded to there are negative voices out there and loud voices out there and ones that just aren't really helpful in promoting joy. In doing that, have you any feedback yet from people who have played with some of these exercises? What have they said to you?
Yeah, people have said that they have found, you know, they're, first of all, they're fascinated by like looking at their punctuation or, you know, they're fascinated by playing with how much of an expert or a companion. I think it's really opened up people's eyes to the fact that there's just so many possibilities. And most of the people that I'm working with are or self-identify as writers, right? So that they're coming to it with things already in place, but they're saying, you know, this has changed the way that I approach my writing. A couple of people have said, you know, now I always look at the rhythm of it. Now I always do this, which is fascinating. And I really, really hope, though, that it just frees up a lot of the weight people bring to writing. People sometimes sit down and think, now I have to write. This is serious. And I would rather people think, now I get to write. Let's do something fun.
3 hours goes by like that. If you're really putting yourself in that moment. Speaking of fun, I love the cover of your book, and I'm going to find some way to showcase it because it is brilliant. I want to use the word zen. That sounds a little goofy, but graphics are beautiful. It's the sound wave of pencils of varying heights. It is one of the most fun covers I've seen in a long time, and we talked about judging books by their covers, and I totally do at times. It's judgy, but
we all do. And I have to give props to Carla Green of Clarity Design Works, who did that cover for me. She's brilliant and lovely to work with. But she came back with this, and I'm like, oh, that's the one. It's because it plays to the voice, and yet it's writing. It's just such a nice combination. And she also did it to fit in nicely to look as a companion with the other books in the Writer's Process series. So I was just delighted.
It really brought that metaphor to life or to vision, and also to use number two pencils. This time of year, I long for those number two pencils. I just love the way they smell when you pull them out of pencil sharpener.
It's a September thing. We're coming up to fall, and it's a fall thing, right? It's like
I'm going to make a recommendation. I think every college, perhaps every high school literature class would benefit from having this because it gets students out of that same old, like, I'm writing this for you, so you'll approve this and give me an A, which is the most slanted, most boring writing to live through. And it doesn't actually give the writer that experience either of saying, I'm just going to let these thoughts fly, these thoughts and opinions and all the stuff that I've learned. I'm going to really internalize it, share it with the rest of the world. So book is called The Writer's Voice, Techniques for Tuning Your Tone and Style. The wonderful Ann Janzer, writer, supporter of writers, marketer to writers and the rest of us. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks, Liz. It's great talking with you.
If you like what you hear on Embark, share this episode with a friend. Tell people about it on social media, and please subscribe. If you have any story ideas, comments, questions, or just want to say hi, you can get in touch at liz@lizsolar.com. I know you have many choices during the week and your time is limited, so I thank you for the privilege of your time. In the meantime, have a great week. Take care.